Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
And welcome to The Upgrade, the podcast from the team at Lifehacker, where we help you improve your life 1 week at a time. I'm Alice Bradley, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker. Today, we're deviating a little bit from our normal style to present you something we think will be helpful in the present moment. We take the movement for Black Lives extremely seriously, and we've been thinking a lot about what we as The Upgrade can do to support it. So we thought, in true Lifehacker fashion, let's tackle how to protest. For our first interview, our producer, Michaela Heck, will be speaking with author and activist, L.A. Kaufman. They'll discuss how to prepare for a protest and what to expect.
Be very alert to what's going around you and think about how you can, at all times, be acting not just to keep yourself safe, but to keep those with whom you're standing in solidarity safe.
After L.A., we'll be talking with Marianne Cajun, senior staff attorney at Brooklyn Defender Services. She walks us through your rights, what to expect if you are arrested, and how to protect yourself legally during the process.
It is critical that you invoke your right to remain silent and say, I do not want to speak with you. I want to call an attorney, and I want an attorney present with me if I'm going to speak with the police.
We also know that a lot of you have had questions about what you can do to support the movement for Black Lives if you're physically unable to protest. So we also spoke with Charlene Carruthers, an author and activist involved with the movement for Black Lives.
People have been building mutual aid networks to supply first aid, food, ride shares. You can donate money. And for white people in particular, you can talk to and organize other white people around anti-racism and to support policies that are being called for in this particular moment.
I also wanted to mention that at Lifehacker, we've got a ton of content that we specifically created to support protesters and everybody else who's supporting the movement. We've covered what to do if you get pepper sprayed, how to set up your phone before you go to a protest, how to protest safely during the pandemic, and much more. And with that, let's get to our first interview with L.A. Kaufman. L.A. has over 35 years of experience with political organizing and grassroots movements. She's been involved in causes such as the anti-apartheid movement of the 80s, the Iraq War protests in 2003 and 2004, and she's currently active in many of the anti-Trump presidency projects. She's also the author of 2 books on activism, Direct Action, Protest, and the Reinvention of American Radicalism, and most recently, How to Read a Protest, The Art of Organizing and Resistance.
L.A., thank you so much for talking with me today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So I know you have over 35 years of experience, is what I was seeing online, of political organizing and protesting. And I'm just curious, with all of the many protests that you've seen, what is kind of standing out to you the most about this current Black Lives Matter movement, besides the obvious hindrance of us being in a pandemic?
Well, I mean, I think that's the big difference, and it's worth dwelling on that for a moment, because, you know, it always is stepping out of your comfort zone to go to a protest for many, many people. It's not something that a lot of people do day in and day out in their lives. They'll do it at moments of great urgency. And I'm just struck when I see the numbers of people out in the streets right now that, you know, nearly everyone who's out has been in quarantine and self-isolation for months and taking many precautions not to become infected and not to infect others. And this is an incredible act of collective courage in this moment of massive anguish and anger and grieving over the murder of George Floyd and of so many others at the hands of racists and white supremacists, especially in our police departments. So I'm struck, you know, I've lived through many moments where people have been moved in large numbers to suddenly take to the streets. That's something that's happened many times in our country's history. But the fact that it's happening now when going out on the streets is such a risky thing to do, gives it added power. And I think reflects what extreme circumstances we're experiencing and the just complete overload for Black Americans, where you have a pandemic of racism on top of the coronavirus pandemic, and it is just too much to bear.
The title of this episode is How to Protest. We're making it with the idea in mind that listeners might be tuning in because they've never participated in a protest before. So the very first step is, how do you find out where protests are happening in your local area? What are the resources people should turn to?
Well, I always say that getting involved in political activism involves a certain amount of research, and that you have to think of that as part of the work. That doesn't mean it's difficult research. So you're going to do some basic searches on, especially on social media for your community and any protest plans. In New York City, for instance, the main hub, the account that's aggregating information about protests is on Instagram. Things are unfolding so quickly that although there are some places where there are regular websites that are compiling this information, a lot of the protests are being planned with such short notice that social media is a better place to search. And whenever you're going to go to a protest, you're going to be thinking about what feels like a good fit for you. And in particularly in larger communities, there are going to be many different kinds and styles of protests, and you're going to want to try to learn what you can about who's organizing them and think about what's a good fit for you. Maybe you want to go to something that is a faith-based vigil, or maybe you're one of the people who wants to go to a street protest that's happening a little while before curfew because you think that the curfews are themselves an overreach and a breach of our constitutional rights. So you want to go to a march that's going to be, you know, pushing our free rights of expression and standing up for those rights, as well as standing up for racial justice. So you want to kind of look at the time of day and think about what you're comfortable doing. Some people are finding ways to, who are really high risk for coronavirus and who aren't able to go out to a large scale protest at all, are just taking a sign and standing on their street corner so that they are socially distanced while making a statement. So you want to think about what kind of event you want to be part of. And then, as I said, get on social media and take a look and see what's happening in your community.
If you decide that you do want to head out and, you know, be physically present at one of these larger protests, what are things that you should have on hand? And what are things that you should not bring with you?
So the phrase to keep in mind is harm reduction. So you're going to want to, you're going out to a protest, and I salute everyone who's doing that. First and foremost, you're going to be thinking about your COVID protection in this time. So wear the best face covering you have. If you've been using a cloth mask or a bandana, now would be a great time to add a filter to that, to add a coffee filter or some other kind of filter. There's lots of great information online about how to do that. If you're wearing one of those surgical masks, I suggest you look. There's tutorials online on how to fit those better on your face. It involves tying a knot in the elastic on the sides and kind of tucking the side in so it fits better around your cheek. And you're going to want to bring hand sanitizer with you and use it frequently. You're going to want to bring a couple extra pairs of gloves with you if you have them. And I should have said at the beginning with the face coverings, you're going to want to bring one or two extras in a plastic bag with you, because there could be a variety of circumstances under which you might want to switch to a fresh one. That would certainly include if you happen to be in a protest where the police use tear gas. When you get away from the gas, you would want to switch to a fresh mask. But you might also, for instance, just want to put on a fresh mask before you step back into your home, if you're sharing a home with others, especially with people who are in high-risk groups. So you're going to want face protection. If you have goggles or some kind of eye protection, bring those along. You may be able to just keep that in your bag, but if things seem like they escalate, it's a good idea to protect your eyes. You're going to want to bring some wipes if you have them, a bag with some basic cleaning supplies, so like some tissues, hand sanitizer, some wipes, whatever you have to help keep things disinfected. So that's the kind of extra things that you want to bring because we're protesting in the era of coronavirus. And then there's the standard things where you're going to want to bring, you're going to want to have some water with you. It's really easy to get dehydrated when you're protesting, especially if it's hot out. And in the age of coronavirus, you know, you're going to want to kind of be off to the side of the crowd when you lift your mask to drink some water. It's good to have a protein bar or some kind of snack with you, some kind of energy snack, because it gets tiring to be out at a protest. If you're bringing your phone, some people do not bring their phones to protests if they are concerned that they might be at risk of arrest, but you're going to want to have a passcode lock on that. You're not going to want to use your facial recognition or your fingerprint to unlock your phone, because then the police can just hold the phone up to your face or rub it against your hand and open up your phone and see everything that's on it and all your information. So add a passcode if you are bringing your phone. It's a good idea if you're bringing a phone to have a charger with you if you think you're going to be out for a long time. You should not bring anything that could be construed as a weapon, and you should not be carrying any substances that are illegal in your state. So for instance, if you're a cannabis user, but cannabis is not legal where you live, you don't want to have that with you. And you obviously don't want to be bringing along anything extraneous. You want to travel light, have those supplies that you need, but this is not a time to have a bag with a bunch of extra stuff along. It's just going to get in your way.
What about like ID and money?
Yes, you should have a state-issued ID. And it's always a good idea to have a little cash with you, not to have a crazy amount of cash with you. It really varies the situation from, you know, jurisdiction to jurisdiction about whether or not if you get arrested, you have to put up a bond or cash. It varies widely. So I can't offer any generalizations about that, but it's never a bad idea to have a little bit of extra cash in case you get into some kind of jam that you need to get out of, or in case you need it for bail money. And one thing that you should do before going to a protest is another one of those research tasks is look and see if there's a legal support number for your area. In many cases, it's the National Lawyers Guild. They often will provide a hotline where you can call if you should be arrested. What people typically do is they take a Sharpie and they write it on their body, because otherwise, you know, when you're arrested, they typically empty everything out of your pockets. They often take away everything that you have with you. And so that's a way to make sure you have the number. People often write it on their forearms or on the back of their hands. Forearms probably better now, since you're going to be using hand sanitizer throughout the day until you're arrested. And so you can wash off that marking on your hand, on the back of your hand, if you're not careful. So yeah, just write that in Sharpie on you before you go. A Sharpie can also be a good thing to bring to a protest so that other people, you can share that around for other people to share that number.
Is there anything that we need to know about how to exit a protest if you feel like things are just starting to feel unsafe? Is there like a bad way to exit a protest, or is it okay to just leave when you feel unsafe?
I want to speak to two things about that question. One is about just situational awareness in general at a protest. So you're going to want to be really alert to what is happening on all sides of you the whole time you're at a protest. And you're doing that both for yourself and as an act of solidarity for everyone around you. So that if there's any kind of problem, which could be anything from somebody tripping and needing help to somebody who disagrees with the protesters coming and getting aggro, to the police taking violent action, whatever risk there might be, you want to be just keeping on alert to what's going on all sides of you. It's very easy to get swept up in what's happening right in front of you and not noticing what's happening behind you. So I encourage people to stay alert, to look out for one another, And I particularly want to put out a call to people who are going to these protests who are either white or non-Black people of color to be aware of the heightened risk that Black participants in every protest are taking and the ways in which you can help buffer those risks with your bodies. In a lot of moments when there have been escalation at protests, people will call for white people to the front because we know it's part of the racist society that we live in, that when there's a line of white people at the front of a protest, the police are less likely to shoot tear gas and less likely to attack them. So think about what's going on. Be very alert to what's going around you and think about how you can at all times be acting not just to keep yourself safe, but to keep those with whom you're standing in solidarity safe. And if things get too intense, it makes a lot of sense to step back, step off to the side, you know, move to a safer location. Again, always being aware of your surroundings. And I want to say that the aftermath of taking part in a protest now is different because of coronavirus. Once you've left that protest, you need to act on the assumption that you could have been exposed to the virus. So when you get home, you're going to want to take off as much of your contaminated outerwear as you can before you even go back in your house. You're going to want to take a shower right away and launder those clothes, put them separately. If you're sharing living space with others, you probably want to wear a mask indoors for the first few days. You want to be monitoring your symptoms very closely. And many medical authorities are recommending that you get a COVID test if possible. I've seen different recommendations for the timing between 3 to 7 days after participating in the protest until you have a negative test. And even after that, for those first 14 days afterwards, you're going to be monitoring yourself for symptoms, of course, but consider the fact that you could be infected and asymptomatic. Part of your solidarity with others in this time is you don't want to be spreading that to anybody else, right? So just take extra precautions. Really think about the fact that you could not only be infected, but you could be infecting others afterwards. So show that ongoing solidarity by self-isolating after the protests, by getting tested if you can, by being really vigilant about your face coverings and your hygiene in that period after, and limiting your interactions with others in that period after taking part in the protest.
LA, is there anything that I haven't asked you about that you want to make sure our listeners know when it comes to protesting?
I just really want to salute everyone who is either out in the streets or considering going out in the streets right now. It's an extraordinarily dangerous and perilous time. And the fact that so many people are courageously taking part in these actions is the most hopeful thing that has happened since this epidemic has started. And in taking part, we're already seeing that these protests are creating change. So in taking part, you are part of a crucial historic moment, which we hope can finally be a turning point in protecting Black lives, in moving towards racial justice in this country, and in also changing the bad leadership that has allowed the twin pandemics of coronavirus and racism to spread out of control in this moment.
LA, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And now for our interview with Marianne Cation. Marianne is a senior staff attorney at Brooklyn Defender Services. She tells us all about the rights we should know before attending a protest, how to behave if you're arrested, and how to protect yourself.
Hi, Marianne. Thanks so much for coming on The Upgrade.
Of course. Happy to be here.
So my first question is, if you're completely new to protesting, how should someone prepare themselves for going into a protest from a legal standpoint?
So to that end, we recommend before you leave your house, writing the number of a legal services hotline or an attorney who you know and trust on your arm, because it's likely if in the event of your arrest that your phone will be taken and other items off your person will be taken, you won't have access to them. So it's important to have that number readily available to you. We also recommend protesting with a trusted person or people so that you can keep tabs on one another and be there for one another if you are arrested in the event that you yourself can't make a call, can't record your arrest, or in other ways can't advocate for yourself. It's important to have someone else who knows where you are. Now, if that's not possible, telling somebody who's not attending the protest where you are and what to do in the event of your arrest, which would be to call an attorney, is an important thing also, both for your own safety and for the protection of your legal rights. Also, it's important to know your rights before you go to protest. So importantly and relevant to this situation would be knowing that it is legal to protest. You have a First Amendment right to express yourself. And that includes handing out flyers, carrying signs, and you know, I'm speaking for New York City, but also marching on sidewalks. As long as you're not impeding pedestrian progress on those sidewalks, it is 100% legal to protest and to voice your opinion, even if that opinion includes obscenities or things that the police might find objectionable. If you're not threatening anybody, it is legal to protest and legal to express yourself and your feelings about what is happening right now across the United States. You also have the right to remain silent, which everyone knows, but in the moment when you're confronted by an officer, you know, even lawyers tend to speak to the police because it is natural. And I feel like we don't talk enough about the social dynamics and the power dynamics that are at play during a confrontation with the police. So it is critical that you invoke your right to remain silent. And if you are being arrested, it's important to invoke that right. Say, I do not want to speak with you. I want to call an attorney and I want an attorney present with me if I'm going to speak with the police. It's important to reiterate that to yourself before going to a protest, because as I said, many people find themselves in that, many people know their rights, find themselves in that situation and do end up speaking. And it's important that you do not do that. It's critical that you maintain your right to remain silent. You also, again, have the right to an attorney. And refreshing your memory about these rights before you head out is always a good idea, so that when you find yourself in a moment that is high adrenaline, potentially life-threatening and dangerous, they are on the forefront of your mind and you, to the extent possible, are able to protect yourself or other people. And to that end, it is also legal to record the police and to give advice to people who are being arrested, as long as you're not interfering with police duties. And I'll just very briefly say what that looks like. If you are not getting between a police officer and the person that they're arresting, if you are standing back and taking pictures or recording them and not stopping them from conducting official police business, it is 100% legal to do that. It is also legal to remind people who are being arrested that they should remain silent and ask them if they want to have you call a lawyer, if they have a lawyer that you can call for them. So that speaks to just, you know, looking out for each other, which is a big important piece of advice that I have for everyone who's planning on participating in these uprisings, because it's become abundantly clear, if it wasn't clear already, that the police will not look out for you, and nor will many of our elected officials. And so it's critical in this moment and always that we take care of each other and that we help each other whenever possible. And that includes by recording or photographing, which is legal, or by reminding each other of your rights, sharing Know Your Rights information, and sharing the hotline numbers for legal services with people who don't already have them.
To the point about phones, I know it's come up a lot that the police can confiscate everything from your person when they arrest you, and that one of those things is often your phone. Can you talk a little bit about how we should prepare our phones and also about the rights that the police do or do not have when it comes to your personal device?
Absolutely. Another thing that you can do to prepare before you leave your house or at any point before entering a protest zone would be to disable face ID unlock and fingerprint unlock from your smartphone. And the reason for doing that is that the police can use your face and your fingers without your permission, not legally, but it does happen, to unlock your phone. But you do have the right to not consent to a search of your phone. So our advice is to disable those functions and to use a passcode in order to unlock your phone. Our advice is also never to consent to a police search of your phone, either verbally or by unlocking it for them. You do have the right to not have your phone searched. So pursuant to a lawful arrest, so say you are arrested at one of these demonstrations, you can have your phone taken by the police. That does not equate a search by the police of that device. So you should never give them permission to open or unlock your phone or to go through it. We also recommend generally turning off data and location services because those things can be used to track the locations of protesters or to attempt to place you at the scene of something that the police are trying to figure out, you know, who was there and potentially charge people with. And also we recommend when you use your phone for recordings or for photographs, not sharing anything that could potentially identify the people around you. So that means pictures or videos with people's faces or any other identifying information, because we do know that police and prosecutors are surveilling social media to try to identify the people who are participating in these demonstrations.
So I know that a lot of people are being arrested at these demonstrations. And as you said, people have the right to peaceful protest. So what are some of the charges that police might be arresting you under at one of these events?
So one of the most common is disorderly conduct here in New York, which is a violation. It is used generally when police say that people didn't obey a lawful order by the police. It's used also frequently, although this isn't really the definition of disorderly conduct, when people are behaving in ways that the police generally do not like. So I've seen this before for people shouting obscenities at the police, which is a clearly protected form of speech under the First Amendment, even though they may not like it. And people will be arrested for that and then charged with disorderly conduct. That doesn't mean that the charge will ever go anywhere or that the DA's offices will go forward on those charges, but it certainly won't stop you from being arrested and charged by the NYPD or perhaps by another police force using their equivalent of that statute. The other thing that we see often is obstruction of governmental administration. So police often charge people who are objecting to their arrest of a person or even just standing in the close proximity to a person that they decide to arrest with that a charge, which we call OGA, obstruction of governmental administration. So a lot of those types of things, which often amount, you know, when we see these charges as defense attorneys, we realize that somebody just made the police upset. So we'll see, you know, that those sort of charges. We'll also see people arrested in large groups for things like criminal mischief. So if a window is broken or something of that nature, the police may arrest everyone in the vicinity of that broken object with criminal mischief, which is just the destruction of property. So we're seeing a lot of low-level offenses. And unfortunately, here in New York, we are seeing the police abuse their authority once again by charging people with these offenses that actually are eligible for what's called a desk appearance ticket. So obviously, we don't believe they should be charged in the first place with some of these offenses. However, even if they are, they could be issued a summons and told to return at a later date. We're seeing people arrested and held sometimes for way more than 24 hours, which is the amount of time that they should be seen by a judge here in New York City. And just to go back to what I was saying earlier about the ways that people actually act when confronted by the police because of our social conditioning and because of the power imbalance between individuals and police officers, we also know that knowing your rights is not a bulletproof vest. It will not save your life. And in certain instances, I've also seen people who correctly invoke their rights, anger the police officers to the extent that, you know, they are then physically injured or harassed or any other number of things that can happen to them. So I just want to acknowledge that knowing your rights is always a good idea. It's a smart way to prepare for a protest, but there's an extent to which the law can help. And the law is not the answer here. It is a tool in a toolbox of things that we need to use to protect ourselves, to protect others, and ultimately to reform the country that we live in. But it certainly isn't the entire answer. And I just want to acknowledge that for those who may be listening to this and knowing that the police are going to do what they want to do, regardless of what you say or do.
Yeah. To that point, like you mentioned, a lot of people are probably going to be really nervous if they're being arrested for the first time, and probably don't want to like further anger an officer. So what's kind of the least confrontational way to invoke your rights? What's kind of the language that you recommend?
So you can answer the question of what your name is, what your address is, and what your date of birth is. But beyond that, you know, you can say, my name is this, this is where I live, and I don't want to answer any questions. I have a lawyer. Can I please call them? You know, and just kind of keep it very, very simple. Now, that doesn't mean that they won't keep asking you questions. They shouldn't. They're not supposed to. After you invoke your right to remain silent unequivocally and ask for a lawyer also unequivocally, which means you can't say things like, do I need a lawyer? I think I should call a lawyer. I don't think I want to answer any questions. You have to be very clear about it, but you can also do so, you know, just very simply. That doesn't mean that they won't continue to ask you questions, but your responses should be, I don't want to answer any questions. I don't want to answer any questions. I need a lawyer. Just keep it simple. You know, the less you speak to them, the fewer words that are exchanged, the better. And I will say that they're arresting so many people that they're actually loading them onto buses. You know, so it is also likely that, you know, your initial interaction with them will be very scary and potentially violent, but it's unlikely that your face-to-face time after that with the officers is going to be extended. So just remember to keep it simple, and hopefully you will be able to get out on the other side.
You hinted at this earlier about the fact that officers, when they arrest you, may be asking you things that you don't have to comply with. So can you talk about some of those things that officers might tell you that you have to do, such as DNA swabs, I've heard mentioned, things of that nature that people should be aware of that they don't have to comply with?
Yes, DNA is an important thing that the police will be seeking, but that you do not have to provide. So they may try to make that seem like a very basic part of the processing of your arrest. You know, oh, now we're just going to swab your cheek. You know, this is what we do. And then we'll move on to the next part, or we'll just swab your cheek and then you can go, or you just need to provide a sample. You do not have to provide DNA to the police, and you should not consent to your DNA being taken. Now, that being said, there are other ways for the police to collect your DNA, and we want you to be aware of those things. They include offering people water, offering them gum, cigarettes, food, anything that you might consume, but then leave a part of it behind, you know, a plastic water bottle or the butt of a cigarette that then contains your DNA, the police will collect it and store it. And we know here in New York that the NYPD has a massive DNA database, including of people that, you know, should not have their DNA on record. We know the police maintain it and store it for long after they're supposed to do that. So it's critical that you keep yourself out of that database.
So after we're arrested, what are the steps we should take, and what can we expect the process to look like?
So after you're arrested, it is possible that you will not be given a call to an attorney. We are hearing that many people are held without a phone call. So even though an important piece of advice is to write that number on your arm, but it is totally possible that you won't get that call. So that's what part of the reason that it's important that you have someone who knows who to call in the event of your arrest. So your arrest might look like a couple of different things. It's possible that you are arrested and released immediately. It is possible that you are arrested and detained for many, many hours and then released with either a summons or a desk appearance ticket. Again, I am talking specifically about here in New York. And it's also possible that you are arrested and held and then processed and arraigned before a judge. Now, most of the arraignments that I know of, all of them here in New York City, and the same seems to be true elsewhere, are happening remotely, but you will still be brought through the precinct into central bookings, and then you will appear on video in front of a judge, and you'll be assigned a defense attorney if you have not already made a call and been assigned somebody. Once you are released, assuming that you are released, you should document any of your injuries that you've sustained. We advise going to a medical professional and making sure that they're documented that way. Although with COVID-19, I understand the hesitation that people may have about going to a hospital. Try to speak with any physician, perhaps your primary care doctor, and then documenting those injuries yourself. So say you have visible injuries on your person, have someone take time-stamped pictures of them, because these are important things to do, whether you're going to file a civil lawsuit against these officers, file some sort of civilian complaint against the officers, or potentially even go forward with some sort of disciplinary proceeding. I'm not sure exactly what that's going to look like elsewhere. Here, I know that the Attorney General's office is collecting information about people who were assaulted by police or witnessed misconduct. So we advise collecting all that information. Also, people may have recorded or photographed your arrest or your abuse. We advise collecting that information from those people so that these recordings are not lost to time and the deletion of phones or, you know, whatever else might happen, having all of that information as well. We also advise that you find out the badge numbers of officers who might have been involved in any arrest or misconduct. That's also something that you can do for other people while the protests are happening or while you witness abuse, misconduct, or arrests. You can try when it's safe, you know, if it's safe for you to do so, you can try to identify these officers. Now, I know here in New York City that the Legal Aid Society has actually filed a lawsuit because a lot of officers are covering their badge numbers and removing their name tags. So I understand, again, that this is our legal advice. It might not be practicable, but when possible, we advise you to determine the identities of the officers that you're dealing with. The other thing that I want to remind everyone about is just to take care of yourselves, to be kind to yourselves. An arrest, even under what we would consider normal circumstances, is often an extremely violent event. So even, you know, I hesitate to use this word, but routine arrests in my job, I see them all the time, whether it's on body cam footage, whether it's on surveillance cameras, whether it's cell phone footage. Even in arrests where it doesn't appear, people don't even whisper the word police misconduct or brutality, these arrests are still incredibly violent and still incredibly traumatic for the people that are going through them. And at this point in time, we're seeing levels of police brutality just in terms of the numbers of people that are being assaulted that are extremely high. And so I encourage you, if you've been through an arrest, even if it doesn't seem like you experienced the worst of what's happening to people, please take care of yourself and please understand that what you've been through is traumatic and seek help and seek the support of those around you when it's, you know, comfortable for you to do that.
Where, if you want to file a complaint against an officer, where do you do that?
So here in New York, we have the Civilian Complaint Review Board. They collect information about misconduct of officers and they can conduct investigations on their own. The Attorney General's office is also soliciting information about any misconduct, abuse, or wrongful arrests that you may have either experienced or witnessed if they happen to other people. Now, I will say, unfortunately, that at least with the CCRB, they do great work, but they are somewhat impeded by the fact that the NYPD has the ultimate say over whether or not an officer is disciplined. And I will also say that here in New York, we are hampered by the existence of a law called 50A, which is a section of the civil rights law that actually protects the personnel files of officers, including allegations of misconduct, including verified allegations of misconduct where there were in fact findings that they conducted themselves wrongfully or abused somebody or even killed somebody. So those channels should be utilized, but we understand that there are limits to how effective they are. So we also advise people to speak with civil attorneys about filing lawsuits against the city of New York and those officers in particular, if you have been injured and you want to seek damages. That is one of the ways that, officers' names become public, because those lawsuits are often publicly available. And also, if you've been injured, that's something that, you know, you are free to do, to file that suit using a civil attorney.
Marianne, is there anything I haven't asked that you feel is important for people to know?
You know, even if you don't get a call while you're in custody and, you know, you come out blinking into daylight whenever the police decide to release you, it's still important to call a lawyer, you know, just to document everything that you've been through so that they can point you in the right direction, whether it's to a civil attorney or whether you do need criminal representation. It's very important that you use those resources, whether it be the National Lawyers Guild or any of the other hotlines that have been set up. The other thing that I do want to mention is that if you are arrested as part of these uprisings and you have bail set, there are bail funds all over the country that are in place exactly for this purpose, for bailing out people who are involved in these demonstrations. I know the Minnesota Freedom Fund is one. Here in New York, we also have bail funds that are set up specifically for this purpose. And also, I want to mention that even before, bail funds were functioning to grant people their freedom under this oppressive police state. And so they are important organizations to support. If you didn't know about them before, I'm glad people are starting to realize them now. If you are detained or a loved one is detained, definitely reach out to them about potentially buying their freedom. Unfortunately, that is the function of bail here in the United States. And even if you don't find yourself in that situation, which I hope you do not, I think I encourage people to donate to these organizations, you know, including after, you know, hopefully these demonstrations result in serious change. But I don't think that we're going to change everything overnight. So the existence of bail funds and the support for bail funds is something that I definitely advocate now and always.
Awesome. Well, Marianne, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Of course. I'm very happy to talk to you. Thank you so much for covering these issues. They're really critical. And I wish everybody health and safety and justice.
Finally, our interview with activist and author Charlene Carruthers. Charlene has over 15 years of experience in racial justice, LGBTQ rights, and youth leadership work. She was a founding national director of the Black Youth Project 100 and is now a part of the Movement for Black Lives. She's also written a book, Unapologetic, A Black, Queer, and Feminist Mandate for Radical Movements. We spoke with Charlene about the most effective ways to support the movement for Black lives, as well as how to keep progress moving forward, even after the protests end. Charlene, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So, first of all, can you tell us a little bit about the Movement for Black Lives?
So, the Movement for Black Lives is a national space for Black organizations where we discuss politics, the conditions, we develop shared assessments. And really, the essence of it is about figuring out what we can only do when we work together. And so there are literally well over 100 organizations connected to the Movement for Black Lives. We've collectively developed a vision for Black lives that includes racial, economic, gender, LGBTQ, and even land, food and land justice. We have various projects happening across the country. And in this particular moment, the Movement for Black Lives is advancing a strategy to defund policing in the United States and invest in our communities. And what that really looks like is literally taking money from these bloated, ineffective police budgets and reallocating that money into the things that we know actually create community safety.
Mm-hmm. So people, I think, are a little bit Some people are a little bit nervous about the idea of defunding the police. Can you talk about that just a little more, like what that would entail?
Sure. So the truth is that every day in the United States, Black and Brown and Indigenous people are extremely nervous about the police. Many of us live lives where we are surveilled, we are harassed, and frankly, far too many Black people and Brown people and Indigenous people are killed by law enforcement in this country. And even people experience at high rates both instances of domestic abuse and violence and sexual violence from people within law enforcement agencies. And so we're living under the heel of a system or an institution, excuse me, that has the power and the money or resources to actually over our lives. And we envision a world that's radically transformed in which how we deal with conflict, violence, and harm happens radically different. And that means community-based safety solutions, the resources that we need in our communities, such as quality public schools and healthcare and housing, and also environmental justice. And we actually know they have vast impact on the amount of violence that can happen in any given neighborhood and actually create real safety beyond policing.
So, Charlene, there have obviously been demonstrations before for the Movement for Black Lives, for Black Lives Matter, and calls to defund the police before. What is this movement different? And if so, why do you think it is?
Well, I think it's important to note that the particular moment that we're in right now is within a continuum of a long-term movement for Black liberation in this country, and frankly, even worldwide. We know that Black liberation is a global struggle. It's not just about what happens here in the United States. And unfortunately, the reality is that Black people are also terrorized by law enforcement officers around the world. And so this particular moment, we're seeing people rise up across the country in numbers I haven't seen in my lifetime, and surely not in my time since I began organizing and doing activism work a little over 15 years ago. And we're also seeing people move from very liberal reformist ideas of tinkering around the edge to saying, actually, we need to defund the police. And more people saying we need to abolish the police in favor of real community safety beyond policing.
Yeah. What other ways can people support protesters in the movement if they're unable to attend a protest?
There's so many ways to support people. People have been building mutual aid networks to supply first aid, food, actual cash or monetary support, housing, medication, all types of things, connecting people, ride shares, supporting those things, organizing mutual aid, local mutual aid networks. You can donate money to an organization. You can also donate any technical skills that you have to an organization. And for white people in particular, you can talk to and organize other white people around anti-racism, to be anti-racist, and to support policies that are being called for in this particular moment and actually flank our organizations and our demands.
What encourages you and what, if anything, worries you about the current activism you're seeing?
And I'm encouraged by the droves of people showing up, and not just on the streets, but online, people making phone calls, people sending emails, people creating art, the activity that we're witnessing from people across the country and across the world. It inspires me. It's extremely encouraging. And what am I concerned about? That's the second question.
Yeah.
I'm concerned that a vision that we hold for this country, I'm concerned about people who have not held this vision for very long or not held it at all, critiquing it without even studying, without asking questions, jumping to conclusions without taking the time to be curious. Yeah. And when people fail to be curious, we see what happens. When people just assume that something isn't right or someone isn't right, and then they jump to conclusions, they can shut things down. They can actually get in the way of what otherwise could be done. And that's a concern of mine. The other concern is violence from the state and corporations. I am aware of the history of state repression against Black people, Brown people, and Native peoples. When we begin to win, when we begin to make progress, the state being, when I say the state, I mean the government and its agencies and those who act in its proxy as well, they entrench their violence. They oftentimes take it up a notch. And so that's a concern of mine.
So on PBS NewsHour, you said, I want to get this right. You said that the goal is radically shifting and transforming the world that we live in. How will we know when we get there? What will that look like?
How will we know when we get there? I think we're it's an ongoing process. It's not even like an end point. It's when do people actually have their needs met? It is when are people no longer going hungry? When are people actually dealing with the conflict and the harm and the violence that happens in our lives in radically different ways? Does everybody have access to quality health care? You know, I see the fight for universal healthcare is tied to the fight of the abolition of the prison industrial complex. We are often told that we cannot afford to pay for universal healthcare. Meanwhile, we spend billions of dollars on policing, surveillance, and law enforcement in this country every single year. And so I know the money's there, and I would have to add to the military, how much money we spend on all these things. So the money is there. And if this country were actually reprioritize how we spend our resources, then we could actually pay for all the things that people actually need in order to thrive.
Hopefully the protests won't die down for a long time, but at some point they inevitably will. How do we keep the momentum going past that point?
So the truth is we witnessed high levels of mobilizations, protests, direct actions, all sorts of things with people in the streets in 2013 and 2014, right? And to a certain extent in 2016. And then between 2016 and now, I think many people were confronting a Donald Trump presidency and also many local fights on the ground. And we're in this moment. So I think that movements always ebb and flow and that we are in this moment now that, and we should use it to our fullest abilities to talk to as many people, reach as many people, bring as many people into long-term sustained work as possible, and know that the organizing, it didn't end in 2015. And then in 2016, it continued. And so we will continue to organize even when we don't see as many people in the streets, because that means that people could actually, like, they're in conversations in their homes. They're in city council meetings. They're in state legislatures. They are in faith-based institutions. They're in their schools. They're in their healthcare institutions, all kinds of things. I think that I know that movement doesn't just exist in the streets. The streets are an important and essential component to movement. And there are so many other places that people are able to show up.
Charlene, thank you so much for joining us.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
And that's our show. The Upgrade is produced by Michaela Heck and mixed by Brad Fisher. You can reach us by calling us at 347-687-8109 and leaving a voicemail, or write to us at upgrade@lifehacker.com. Find us on Twitter at Lifehacker, on Instagram at lifehacker.com, all one word, and on Facebook at facebook.com/lifehacker. Sign up for Lifehacker's daily newsletter full of tips and tricks and hacks at lifehacker.com/newsletter. And you can find show notes for this and every episode of The Upgrade at lifehacker.com/the show.